the Chinese look at the United States, they are confused.
The U.S. Defense Secretary is in China, perhaps seeking some clarification. It's Thursday, June 28th, and this is VOA Asia. I'm Ira Melman in Washington. You are part of this program, and you are invited to join us on VOA Asia Facebook. Also ahead, a move by Washington possibly aimed at de-escalation of tense relations with Beijing. Afghanistan rejects a claim by Russia that Islamic State is consolidating its presence in Afghanistan. And a call for international involvement in calling out human rights abuses in Myanmar. All on today's VOA Asia. China is committed to peace, but cannot give up even one inch of territory in that country's ancestors left behind. That is what Chinese President Xi Jinping told U.S. Defense Secretary Jim Mattis Wednesday during his first visit to Beijing. Xi's remarks underscore deep-rooted areas of tension in Sino-U.S. ties, particularly over what the Pentagon views as China's militarization of the South China Sea. However, irritants in U.S.-China relations extend to other sensitive areas, including fears of a full-blown trade war between the world economic heavyweights. Beijing is also deeply suspicious of U.S. intentions towards self-governing and democratic Taiwan, which is armed by the United States. China views the island as a sacred part of its own territory. Meeting in Beijing's Great Hall of the People, state television reported Xi told Mattis that China had only peaceful intentions and would not cause chaos. Mattis, in comments in front of reporters, told Xi that talks had been very, very good. VOA's Victor Beatty spoke with Brad Glosserman, a senior advisor to the security think tank Pacific Forum and deputy director of the Tokyo-based Tama University Center for Rulemaking Strategies. Glosserman said the relationship between the U.S. and China is vital.
Our relations with China are vital. Two countries that are number one in two economies of the world, that have many places where they're interests overlap and where, quite frankly, their interests diverge and where our militaries are bumping up against each other on an increasingly regular basis. It is, I think, extremely important that we understand each other's strategic intentions, have an understanding of capabilities, and establish rules of engagement and communication such that when we do meet each other, by accident or by intention, we understand what the other's trying to do and that there isn't any misperceptions or misinterpretations of what's about to go down.
It's interesting that his visit coincides with the third U.S. aircraft carrier plying the waters of the South China Sea, the USS Ronald Reagan. And at the same time, a formation of Chinese warships has been holding daily combat drills for more than a week in waters near Taiwan. Any coincidence here?
I don't think so. I mean, in the sense that if you look at the tempo of operations these days by both navies, you'll see that it would be very, very difficult to schedule meetings as far in advance as these things have to be arranged, and that did not overlap at some point with scheduled military operations. Both occur. The military exercises or the big bilats occur well in advance. You know, in the absence of a big event that would force the cancellation of one or the other, there's just extremely likely to be something occurring at some time somewhere that if somebody wants to draw attention to it, you can always say, this don't look like they're particularly consistent, as you just did.
How would you characterize bilateral relations right now? China, of course, is very concerned about U.S. trade actions. Wednesday, in the Global Times, the state-run publication saying that China should take self-defense measures against U.S. tariffs, offering subsidies to companies and industries that may suffer losses from trade frictions.
And I think that the easy answer right now is that if the Chinese look at the United States, they are confused. They are not sure what to make of the pronouncements of the president and the gap between both his pronouncements and then the reconciliation of that between the relationship he has with President Xi or claims to have, and then the broader set of relationships within, you know, the basket of interests that the two countries have to work on. I think on the military side, interestingly enough, I think I see a little bit more stability in the sense that there is less of the back and forth. I think there is a harder line in the sense that both countries are increasingly inclined to see the other as adversarial and somewhat antagonistic. You see that in the language of the national security strategy, the U.S. national security strategy, the national defense strategy. You see it you know, in an up-tempo in regard to our deployments and our operations in the South China Sea that you note, the exercises that are occurring, even though at the same time we are trying to work together on denuclearizing and dealing with the North Korean nuclear threat. And the Chinese are doing what comes, as I've told you in the past, with what comes with great power status, which is an increasingly muscular and assertive foreign policy, more money and attention devoted to the military. And thus, again, because of the divergence of interest in our two governments, our two countries, that the two are going to be brushing up against each other.
Brad Glosserman said while the two countries are not hostile, there is a greater sense that they are competing and edging toward antagonism. In that context, he added, visits like that of Mattis take on even greater importance. As the U.S. Defense Secretary was speaking with Chinese officials, the Trump administration was de-escalating a confrontation with China, dropping plans to impose strict limits on Chinese investment in U.S. technology companies, and instead urging Congress to strengthen existing laws that apply to all foreign countries. We invite you to read more on our top story by following us on Facebook, VOA Asia, and at the voanews.com website. These are among the top stories currently trending on voanews.com. Supermarkets, food delivery outlets, and street vendors in Mumbai, India are scrambling to replace plastic bags, containers, and bottles as authorities impose a sweeping ban on single-use plastic items in that country's biggest city. Malaysian police say they have seized nearly $275 million in cash, jewelry, and luxury handbags in raids on properties linked to scandal-tainted ex-Prime Minister Najib Razak. South Korean businesses that operated in the Kaesong Industrial Complex in North Korea are anxious to visit the facility to prepare for the possibility of restarting operations. Expanded coverage of these stories and more on Facebook at VOA Asia and on the voanews.com website. We continue on VOA Asia. Authorities in Afghanistan have rejected the latest Russian claims that thousands of Islamic State fighters are consolidating their presence in 9 out of 34 provinces of that war-hit country. Afghan Defense Ministry spokesman Mohammad Radmanish at a news conference Wednesday in Kabul estimated that about 2,000 IS militants operate in four provinces, including Nangarhar, Kunar, and Nuristan in the east, with Jawzan in the north. Radmanish was speaking a day after the Russian envoy to the United Nations told a Security Council meeting on Afghanistan about Moscow's concerns about growing influence of Islamic State fighters, particularly in northern provinces that border Central Asian countries. I spoke about the number and effect of non-state actors in Afghanistan with Michael Kugelman. He's deputy director and senior associate for the South Asia program at the Washington-based Wilson Center think tank.
This is the whole, the epitome of the challenge in Afghanistan, that what do you do about these groups like the Taliban and the Haqqani network and other militant groups, ISIS too for that matter, that are active in Afghanistan? You know, ISIS is hard to control. It has no state sponsorship, no state support. It's getting to be stronger in Afghanistan. You know, the U.S. and the Afghans have been undertaking airstrikes for a number of years. It hasn't worked. The Taliban, you know, it's getting support from Pakistan. There's reason to think it's also getting support from Iran and also Russia. But, you know, the problem is that, you know, when you look at how the U.S. could approach this, all of these countries are problematic for the U.S. You know, the U.S. has a difficult relationship with Pakistan, with Russia, with Iran, and also China, which is increasingly stepping up its role in Afghanistan, mainly in terms of economic support. But, you know, it's very hard for the U.S. to deal with this because it has a great relationship with the government in Kabul, but the government in Kabul is wildly unpopular in Afghanistan. And these other countries that border Afghanistan are countries that don't get along with the United States. So I think that at the end of the day, what have you, you have really a pretty big, ugly mess.
Is there any proof that China, Russia, and some of the other nations, as you just mentioned, that border Afghanistan and Pakistan are playing a part in any of this?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's clear that Pakistan continues to provide a safe space, at the very least, to the Taliban. There's a permissive environment where leaders from the Taliban and the Haqqani network are allowed to hang out there and nothing happens to them. And meanwhile, Iran is indeed, particularly its intelligence services, have there's a fair amount of evidence to indicate that it has provided episodic levels of military support to the Taliban, particularly in the western parts of Afghanistan, bordering Iran, which is, I think, one reason why you see an upsurge in offensives of the Taliban in western Afghanistan in recent weeks, including in the province of Farah, which led to the Taliban briefly seizing some government facilities in the provincial capital. Russia is a little more complicated. Clearly, Russia is trying to outreach to the Taliban. It's trying to engage. There's not as much evidence to suggest that the Russians are providing military support, but clearly that engagement is there. So this just makes the whole Afghanistan conundrum even more tricky because, you're not dealing with an insurgent group that has one that has a cross-border sanctuary. It has that, but it also has been able to diversify its source of support, and that the Iranians and perhaps the Russians are now getting involved too.
What about China?
I mean, China, it's opaque. It's a bit harder to tell exactly what's going on, but China values stability and development in Afghanistan because it wants to have its Belt and Road Initiative get through the region. It has to go through Afghanistan. So China is really keen to do infrastructure development and things like that in Afghanistan. However, it really is hard to do that so long as the situation is unstable. So what China is trying to do is trying to deepen its connections to the Taliban, not in terms of military support, but to try to get the Taliban to agree to look favorably upon the idea of peace talks. Because China, like so many other countries in the region, and also the U.S., recognizes that the only way to bring more stability in Afghanistan and to end the war is to have a negotiation. But that requires the Taliban to actually agree to it.
Afghan President Ashraf Ghani reiterated Wednesday he is ready to hold direct peace talks with the Taliban leader, Malawi Habatulah Akhundzada, anywhere he wants. In an opinion piece published by the New York Times Wednesday, Ghani called for building on unprecedented separate ceasefires his government and the Taliban observed this month during the three-day Muslim festival of Eid al-Fitr. American military commanders dismiss Russian claims about the growing IS strength in Afghanistan, saying the campaign is aimed at justifying Moscow's support to the Taliban insurgency, charges Russia rejects. Happening now in Asia, Amnesty International says it has credible evidence implicating 13 Myanmar officials, including a top military commander, with crimes against humanity for their roles in the campaign against Rohingya Muslims that began last August. Thai soldiers, volunteers, and members of a Navy SEAL unit worked through the night trying to find a group of young soccer players trapped inside of a cave as the search for the team entered a fourth day on Wednesday. Stay up to date with VOA. You're listening to VOA Asia. Staying in South Asia, Pakistan has a mixed record on press freedom. Although the media is vibrant and there are many TV news channels, state and non-state actors often threaten or harass journalists. Since last year, harassment from state actors, particularly against those critical of Pakistan's powerful military or its intelligence agencies, has significantly intensified. VOA's Aisha Tanzim reports from Islamabad.
When journalist Marvi Sirmad returned home with her family last week from vacation, she was shocked to find her house upside down. She feared a robbery until she noticed that most of her valuables, like watches and jewelry, were taken out of drawers but left behind, whereas two laptops, a phone, and some of her family's travel documents were missing. The pattern was disturbingly familiar. This was the third time this had happened to her.
They've gone through my files on human rights cases. They only took laptops with current data on them. Similarly, they checked my voice recorders thoroughly. What kind of thieves are interested in only data and documents?
Sirmad is a known critic of the military as well as extremist groups. According to the Independent Human Rights Commission of Pakistan, anyone critical of the state these days is being targeted, reportedly by security agencies. While journalists in Pakistan are used to harassment from state and non-state actors, the intensity and frequency has increased significantly since last year. In a recent report on Pakistan, Amnesty International highlighted the impunity with which journalists and rights activists are subjected to harassment, threats, attacks, and even enforced disappearances. Increasingly, newspaper columnists are openly complaining that editorial comments have been subjected to censorship. Pakistan's oldest English-language newspaper, Dawn, published a statement complaining that officials have threatened newspaper hawkers and disrupted paper distribution in parts of the country. On the other hand, Pakistan military spokesman has accused some journalists of becoming pawns to anti-state elements.
What do we do about these that we have left blank? They are using their original handles to retweet or approve of tweets that are against the country.
The pressure has intensified to the extent that a recent survey by advocacy group Media Matters for Democracy found that 88% of Pakistani journalists self-censor. Free speech advocates are demanding an end to the harassment. So far, they say they have not received a positive response. Meanwhile, Sirmad and her family wonder how many more times they'll have to pick up the pieces. Aisha Tanzeem, VOA News, Islamabad.
Thank you for being with us. You're listening to VOA Asia.
News is mobile and so are you. Get VOA on the go. Get VOA on Google Currents. Get VOA News specifically made for your tablet and smartphone. Clean, simple, fast. Now available for Android or Apple phones or tablets. Download the Google Currents app for free today. Get VOA on Google Currents at voanews.com/currents.
This news alert from VOA Asia. The U.S. dollar rallied against most currencies Wednesday, including against traditional safe havens like the Swiss franc and Japanese yen, after a moderation in the U.S. administration's approach to Chinese investment. The U.S. ambassador to the United Nations, Nikki Haley, told India's Prime Minister Narendra Modi Wednesday that it was important that India cut Iranian oil use, but said the U.S. would work to allow India to use an Iranian port as corridor to Afghanistan. Visit VOA Asia Facebook every day for top stories and great features to see and share. This is VOA Asia. A UN investigator is warning Myanmar's unprecedented level of human rights violations and abuses against its people will not end without concrete action by the international community against the government and military authorities there. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva with a special rapporteur on the situation of human rights in Myanmar, submitted her report to the UN Human Rights Council.
In a blistering report to the council, investigator Yangi Lee notes more than 10 months have passed since violence by the Myanmar military against the Rohingya minority in Rakhine State forced 700,000 to flee to Bangladesh. And yet, she says, nothing has been done. That despite credible evidence that widespread and systematic attacks continue against the Rohingya, possibly amounting to crimes against humanity.
Far too many alleged crimes have been committed and have been documented and reported with scant consequences faced by those who perpetrated them. On ensuring accountability for gross violations of human rights and serious violations of international humanitarian law in Myanmar, we must admit that so far the United Nations and the international community have failed once again.
The UN investigator acknowledges the primary responsibility for looking into allegations of gross violations lies with the state concerned. But she notes none of the investigations established by Myanmar's government or military has met the standards of international law. She also questions the credibility of a recently established inquiry set up by the government to address the situation in Rakhine.
This is the sixth domestic inquiry to be set up under the Aung San Suu Kyi-led government, and no inquiry yet effectively holding perpetrators to account.
Lee says the best way to obtain impartial, credible, and independent findings is for the government to grant her access to the country and to allow the fact-finding mission established by the council to do its job. The permanent secretary of Myanmar's Foreign Affairs Ministry was not swayed by these arguments. U Minh Thu showed his animus toward Yanggi Lee by calling on the UN Council to replace her with another special rapporteur. He says his government will not cooperate with Lee because she lacks objectivity and that her assessments of the situation in his country are neither impartial nor balanced. Rohingya have been denied citizenship even though many of their families have lived in Myanmar for generations. Myanmar denies accusations of ethnic cleansing. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Here's a news alert from VOA Asia. A British newspaper is reporting that the perilous Khyber Pass will become a four-lane expressway to boost trade between Pakistan and Central Asia. Hong Kong is back on top as the most expensive city for expatriates, according to Mercer's 24th annual cost of living survey. The survey, which assesses the price of goods and services in more than 200 cities, put Hong Kong back into the top spot after giving the most expensive label to Luanda, the capital city of Angola, last year. All the big stories come your way through the day on VOA Asia Facebook. This is VOA Asia. There is an exciting new breakthrough in treating deadly brain tumors. Doctors have used a modified polio virus to treat people with brain cancer. VOA's Carol Pearson reports the results so far are promising.
How many fingers? Three. How many? Two.
Stephanie Hopper is having a standard neurological test. She was diagnosed with glioblastoma, an aggressive brain cancer, 8 years ago. Surgeons removed the tumor, but it returned 2 years later. The survival rate for glioblastoma is low, at best a year and a half after diagnosis. Hopper entered a study that uses a genetically modified poliovirus developed at Duke Cancer Institute. The modified virus doesn't cause paralysis, but it does shrink the tumor. A clinical trial showed that the treatment significantly improved long-term survival for patients whose glioblastoma had returned. The 3-year survival rate was 21% for these patients, while only 4% of patients with the same type of recurring brain tumors were alive 3 years after having what was then the standard treatment. Even a dead poliovirus causes a very strong immune response. The dead virus is used in the polio vaccine. At Duke University Medical Center, researchers wanted that strong immune response, but without any chance of getting polio, so they modified the virus. Dr. Daryl Bigner is the senior author of the study.
What this did, very simply, was to destroy the ability of the poliovirus to infect nerve cells and cause poliomyelitis any longer, but it retained the ability to kill cancer cells.
Doctors injected the modified virus directly into the brain. They repeated the treatment on 5 patients whose cancer returned.
Those that we've been able to follow long enough have responded to the treatment the second time.
The procedure is still experimental, but the results are so promising that doctors have started a second study combining the poliovirus with chemotherapy to try to improve the results. As for Stephanie Hopper, her tumor continues to shrink. Carol Pearson, VOA News.
A Japanese space probe has arrived at an asteroid after a 3.5-year, 300 million kilometer journey through deep space to collect information about the origins of the solar system. The Japanese Aerospace Exploration Agency says the Hayabusa 2 probe entered into a position about 20 kilometers above the Ryugu asteroid Wednesday. The probe will spend the next 18 months taking photographic images of Ryugu, which is named after an undersea palace in ancient Japanese folklore, and deploy a French-German-built lander to study the surface. And if you hadn't heard, Germany crashed out of the World Cup. and lost to South Korea 2-0. You've been listening to VOA Asia. Get our program on iTunes and SoundCloud and download our podcast to take VOA Asia with you. I'm Ira Melman in Washington. Have a wonderful day.